Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm delighted to have with me today in the studio Dr. John Schofield. He's Head of Department in Archaeology, Director of the Cultural Heritage Management MA programme at the University of York. And perhaps I'll just say a few words about my guest. Dr. Schofield was previously an archaeologist with English Heritage, where he had the dual responsibilities of being inspector in the characterisation team and head of military programmes. He joined English Heritage back in 1989 and had numerous roles at that time within heritage protection and policy in particular. Over the past 10 years, he's supplemented work in the heritage sector with regular teaching commitments in the UK and overseas. Dr. Schofield is docent in cultural heritage, landscape and contemporary archaeology, also at the University of Turku in Finland. His research interests focus on cultural heritage management, landscape, archaeology of the contemporary past and conflict archaeology. He has published extensively in all these fields, and recent examples include his co-edited Heritage Reader of Routledge, 2008, a publication called Aftermath, Readings in the Archaeology of Recent Conflict, another one in 2009, Defining Moments, and many others. He has plenty of current projects. One of his projects has been about Straight Street here in Malta, and I think that's mainly what we're going to be speaking about today. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Schofield.
Thank you very much.
Well, there are plenty of things in this little, rather short bio that interest me very much, particularly conflict archaeology, so I hope that we'll have time to talk about that. So let's start off with Straight Street. What actually inspired your interest in Straight Street? An archaeologist in a contemporary situation. That's rather interesting.
Yes, it is, and it all started, in fact, with the phrase you used just now, conflict archaeology. That's where it all began, and I was invited over to Malta in 2004 to participate in an archaeology of the Second World War conference, which was organised by Heritage Malta. And first evening of the conference, we went for dinner at a restaurant in Valletta, and the people I was with started asking about my interest in conflict archaeology and how far it extended. And I explained how it wasn't just about the bunkers and the military installations, it was also about the social landscape that went with that. And one of the people I was with said, so you know about Straight Street then? And of course I didn't know anything about Straight Street. So after dinner and after dark, we went for a walk down the bottom end of Straight Street, that end of Straight Street known as the Gut, to many of the sailors that frequented it, and I was completely hooked. And the reason I think I was completely hooked as an archaeologist is that it was just all the locked doors, the bolted doors, and the stories that almost certainly lay behind those doors, and the physical traces in the rooms behind those locked doors, and the evidence that they provide for what went on there in the past. And that's what archaeologists do, of course. They might look at appears on the surface to be a blank canvas, a blank landscape about which we know very little, and they'll start to conduct geophysical surveys and aerial photography and small excavations, and gradually the story will start to build up. And in this case, of course, it wasn't a ploughed field, it wasn't a piece of rural landscape, it was an urban landscape with locked doors, but exactly the same principle. It was about uncovering and revealing the secrets that were behind these doors, and the stories and the memories of the people that occupied this place in the past.
Well, yes, certainly an excavation with a difference.
Yes, and in fact we did think of it as an excavation. It was a pulling back of the layers to reveal the stories and the memories that were hidden underneath.
It is interesting that in actual fact you knew absolutely nothing about Straight Street, because many people in Britain who have had any connection at all, and many of them have, sailors, people who are even here during the war, would, if they know nothing at all about Malta, they'd know something about the Gut. So it's very interesting that you came in really with no preconception about it.
Yes, I really knew nothing about Straight Street, and in fact I knew very little about Malta. I'd never had cause to really learn about Malta. I'd never been to Malta before. My work with English Heritage English Heritage's remit is very much England, and so there was no real scope within English Heritage to conduct research anywhere other than in England. And this was at a time when English Heritage was just starting to broaden out a little bit and take a wider interest in, for example, in this case, colonial heritage as well. So I really didn't know anything about Malta. I didn't really know anything about, certainly didn't know anything about Strait Street. I knew a little bit about its role in the Second World War, of course, but at a very sort of superficial level. And I was invited to this conference really to talk about World War II heritage in England, and that's why I was here. But it was a wonderful visit, of course, because I was exposed to the fabulous heritage that you have in Malta, not just the Second World War heritage, but also some of the earlier periods as well that I used to be interested in. I still am interested in, but it's less prominent now. And it's a wonderful place, and I've had the privilege to come back several times since, obviously, to conduct my Strait Street research.
I can imagine you walking up Strait Street that fateful evening when they took you for the first time. I can imagine that as an archaeologist you did find it fascinating. The methodology could have had theoretical part to it. You could probably sat down after the visit and said, you know, how can I go about this? But the theory then had to move on into practice. So I'm very interested to hear actually how you went about approaching Strait Street, both from the physical point of view, locked doors, and also obviously from the more sociological point of view.
The two things are very closely linked, in fact. And that first evening when we walked down Strait Street, I remember one of my hosts explaining that you know, this is now an empty street, there's no one here anymore, it's an abandoned place, and certainly it had the feel of an abandoned place. And I went back again once more before I left for England, and just walked down there in the daytime. And again, I saw absolutely nobody. It was an empty space, certainly down at the bottom.
What year was this? Remind me.
This was 2004. And then I got back to England and I put in a small grant application to come back and do some research, which was obviously successful. So I came back, I think it was a year later, 2 years later maybe. And the first thing that I did was to simply spend time in Strait Street, walk up and down the street repeatedly, and eventually what I started to do was to actually, I felt I need my wanderings needed a bit of a purpose. I needed to be seen to be doing something, so I started taking photographs of every doorway, which I didn't strictly need to do, but it seemed to be a thing that would draw attention to myself. And I thought, if there are people here, if I start taking photographs of every doorway, someone's going to take notice and someone's going to come and ask me what I'm doing. And sure enough, that's what happened. And gradually people started to come down from the flats above the former bars and dance halls and so on, to start a conversation with me, which of course ultimately led to the question, so what are you doing? And the answer to which of course was that, you know, taking an interest in this place. Without any preconceptions, this is purely a sort of an objective archaeological perspective on a place about which I know very little, and I want to find out about it. It fascinates me for some reason. There's something about this place that grabs me, and I want to uncover some of these stories. So by just simply being in the street, taking photographs, people gradually appeared, and those people became very important to the project, because the project was very much about the places, as you say. It was about the sort of fabric, and also about the people. And the people, of course, are integral to the story. Some of the people were able to provide access to some of the places, and once you're inside some of these empty places and you're there with someone that used to work there, then that animates the space as well. It's not just about supposition, it's not just making sense of where the chairs happen to be placed or how the space might have been used in the past. You have the physical evidence which you can draw upon, but you also have someone there to tell you a little bit about what it was like, the character of this bar, as opposed to all the other bars up Strait Street. I should say one more thing, which is that there was one person who's been extremely important in this project, who single-handedly, I would say, unlocked more doors than anyone else, and that was Victor Sherry. And Victor was someone we met very early on in the project, responded to a letter that I placed in the Times of Malta, and was very willing to help. So it wasn't just a question of being up and walking up and down the street and meeting the people from the flats who above the former bars, but Victor was also a very helpful ally.
And he helped you with the language question, or did you not find that a problem?
It was only a problem on one or two occasions, and I don't know whether those people couldn't speak English or chose not to speak English, but in both those situations Victor was there to act as a translator. But in all other cases English was spoken, yes.
So tell me something about the things that you did discover in those early moments of your research.
I think the first thing to say was just the sheer excitement at seeing some of these doors unlocked, and the rusty key and the rusty lock, and the effort that was involved in turning the key in the lock. It clearly hadn't been open for some time, and then the doors open, the sunlight enters the room, and it's almost like the moment when Tutankhamun's tomb was first opened and the stones were removed and they looked through the hole in the wall and could see everything that was in the room. It felt a little bit like that. And the first bar that we went into was right at the very bottom of Straight Street, right down at the far end, just as you go down that last flight of steps, and on the left-hand side, and it was the Monte Carlo Bar. It's now a workshop, and the owner of that workshop is the son of the former owner of the bar, and explained how this bar had been opened by his father. He was very proud of his father's entrepreneurial vision, I suppose, to recognise the opportunity here to design the bar, to build all of the furniture himself. The Art Deco bar, for example, was built by his father.
Is it still there, extant?
The bar is still there. The physical bar is still there. The mirror behind the bar is still there. But it's now a very busy workshop, full of all his bits and pieces. And he explained to us in great detail and with great passion how he'd retained all of that, even though it was a bit inconvenient to use a workshop and have all these bits of furniture in the way, effectively. But he'd retained it all in honour of his father, to use his precise words.
That showed a bit of vision,
and also a clear recognition that the heritage of this place was important. And it kind of went against everything that we'd been told up until that point, which was about stigma, about shame, about how this place was a dreadful place. It didn't fit with the local the values that went with obviously a country that identifies very strongly with the Catholic, Roman Catholic faith, and so on and so on. All of this had been made very clear to us by various people that we'd met, and then here all of a sudden was a lovely man whose father had owned this bar and who was standing there telling us how proud he was of his father, and he'd retained all of this in this workshop in honour of his father, and that changed everything. That visit changed the way that we thought about Straight Street.
Some of the theatre places that there are there, some of the original theatres have remained in actual fact, haven't they? Did you go into those as well, I presume?
Yes.
Into practically every door?
No, we didn't. We got to about, I think we got up to about 30%. We reckon that there were probably 80 bars in Straight Street and at various times. And the problem with making sense of all of this, or one of the problems, is that bar names change frequently. The road numbering changed at various points, notably after the Second World War, after the bomb damage and so on. So it's very hard to sort of match building numbers and bar names and look at them through time, because the landscape is constantly in a state of flux. That made things a little bit difficult. But overall, we think we managed to get into about 30% of these places, which was 30% more than some people said we'd be able to achieve. So we're very pleased with that. But of course, what it does mean is that there are lots of places down Straight Street that we've never been into, either because we've just never met the right person with the right key, or because those people are simply not around anymore.
Would some of the people that you met, so you say you met this guy in the Monte Carlo bar, and several others of those 30% that you managed to visit, what were really the main issues that came up? I mean, obviously words like, you know, memory come to mind. You must have been quite systematic in your approach to seeing what the memories were, or was it not so systematic?
It wasn't, actually, and I suppose a lot of the textbooks tell you that, you know, you should have a set of questions and ask the same questions to the same people and so on, and that works, I think, in some situations, but where you're dealing with people who are perhaps rather suspicious anyway of your motivations, and people were suspicious, they didn't really at first necessarily trust what we were doing. We would explain that we were, you know, from a British university, we were purely interested in this as a research exercise. We wanted to capture memories and stories and so on. But nonetheless, I think people were a little bit wary. And so asking them to fill out questionnaires or asking them a set of questions, I think wouldn't have gone down so well. So what we did instead was simply have conversations, and we let them lead the conversations. So we hoped that they would just talk to us and we would make notes on the things that they told us, on the basis that things they told us were obviously the things that were important to them, and that's what we were really interested in. Of course, there were questions that we could then ask, and we could respond to some of the points they made, but we really wanted the gist of the conversation really to come from them rather than be driven by us. So an ideal situation, for example, would be to go into, let's say, the Cairo bar halfway down Straight Street on the left-hand side as you go away from the city gate, and to go in there with one of the people that we met who still lives above the Cairo bar, or did when we were last in Malta a few years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. He was a dancer in the Cairo bar, and he also ran it for a while as well, after his mother died, and to go into the Cairo bar with him, and to just then let him talk, rather than barrage of questions coming from us about, so what happened here, what happened there, where was the bar, what did this happen, what, you know, what was this for, and so on, and how did this bar relate to the bars next door, and so on. It was very much turned on its head, and it was simply a conversation by him which we responded to.
And was his memories were of his life and his family's lives at that time? What were the issues really that were foremost in people's minds?
One of the things that came up a lot, perhaps not surprisingly, was the question of prostitution. And we heard very conflicting comments on that. Some people were very keen to emphasize that it simply didn't exist in Straight Street. Some people were very willing to emphasize that it did and to give us very clear examples of where this had happened. So I think that was one of the key issues. But I think the main thing, and the thing that came up most often, and in fact in pretty much all the conversations, was the fact that it was a good life. It was fun. It was,
you know, made money. They made money.
Yeah, they made a living. Absolutely. They made lots of friends. I think one of the striking things for us was going to the Rocks Bar, which is on the right hand side, about halfway down, and talking to the owners of the Rocks Bar, where they had in the bar, although the bar is now completely closed, of course, they still use it as a sort of as a space. They don't live there, but they visit. And in there, they've got things like framed pictures of U.S. naval ships with the signatures of the ship's company. They've got various souvenirs. They've got a flag from one of the U.S. ships, which they kept beautifully folded and unfolded for us with great ceremony in this bar, and explained the story behind it. We went into the back room, which is now a storeroom, which used to be the loos at the back. And even though a lot of this place has now been redecorated, the walls of the loo were still engraved with and carved with the names of sailors. And I asked, why have you not redecorated this bit? Why have you left all the graffiti on the loo wall? And he said, well, these are the names of all our friends. It's a memory wall, effectively.
That's a lovely idea.
And I think that idea of the life that people still hark back to and have actually fond memories of, was a very prominent theme, even though everyone was also very aware of the fact that crime happened in Straight Street. People died there, people were murdered there, there probably was prostitution. Even though Straight Street wasn't the focus of it, it was a bit further down towards Fort St Elmo, it nonetheless did happen there a little bit. So there was a recognition that it wasn't all rosy, but in amongst everything that was happening there, there was a good life, basically.
This idea that the British Navy, and not only obviously not only sailors used to go there, but obviously other army personnel, they used to regulate things very much. It was very much regulated. They used to go and check. They knew that their sailors used to go and enjoy an evening there, and there was the piano bar and the singing and the theatre and this sort of thing. But they used to keep tabs on them, and they used to be, I suppose, what would be the equivalent of military police or whatever, who used to actually go up and down. Did this come up in the conversation?
Oh yes. And we placed a notice for information in the Navy News, for example, and we had a lot of response to that. This is a newspaper that former naval personnel of all ranks read, and we had a huge response, and a lot of that was actually from military police, for example. We've got some wonderful accounts from some of the military patrols. There's one concerning a military patrol on Christmas Eve, which in early 1960s, I think, and it's great detail, and it's beautifully written. And it tells the story of a military patrol starting early in the evening and going through to the early hours of the following morning. So there's lots of detail about that, and of course the stories of people like Tiny, the policeman who used to stand on the corner by the loos, almost at the midway point of Straight Street, where you get the view both ways down the street, and wonderful stories about him. And
keeping
we were able
tabs.
To contact his keeping tabs, but in a very fair way. And he was, although some of the police are described by some of our informants as thugs, Tiny certainly wasn't, and he's very fondly remembered by everyone as being very big, very fair, gentle giant.
Yes, lovely.
And we had contact with his family, and that was very nice as well to have that link.
Interesting. You actually managed to find them.
Yes, God, that's
good.
Yes.
I remember one thing I read, that they used to, for example, go and check the mattress. There were bed and breakfasts, I imagine some of the similar to that, in Straight Street. And the naval personnel used to actually go and inspect the mattresses to make sure that they didn't have bugs on them, because it was in their interest to do so, because they wanted to keep the sailors healthy. They didn't want them coming back to the ship sick or anything
that. Yes, exactly. And I think there was a lot of concern for their well-being and so on, even in the 1950s and 60s. I guess that's improved over time, but it was certainly there back then as well.
And the idea of friends as well. I mean, I know a more contemporary bar, which has just closed in actual fact, which used to be a point of entertainment for military personnel from Pembroke Barracks.
I think that idea of people coming back is quite prominent, and certainly the time that I spent in Straight Street over the last few years, I don't think a day went by without meeting a former sailor who was back with his family on a package holiday to Malta, and part of that holiday involved just heading back to the gut to sort of just reminisce a little bit. And the thing that struck me about that in particular was the importance of the bar signs, because those are the kind of geographical markers that sailors use when they return. They remember a bar, perhaps, and they'll say, yes, it was near the Blue Peter Bar, and it was just downhill and on the same side. So, of course, the sign is still there, or was last time I was here, for the Blue Peter Bar. And then they can start to reconstruct and work out where this place was that they used to go to. There may only be five or six bar signs left now, but provided you have that, you've at least got those reference points. When they've all gone, you've got absolutely nothing. And I think retaining those is really important.
What about the conflict archaeology? How does that fit in? How does Straight Street fit in with that idea of conflict? Is it because you see it as counterculture? What is it exactly?
I think it's just part of the same thing, really. I mean, if you think of military, the military as a concept and the way the military works as a community, and with the role that they perform, the military themselves talk about the teeth and the tail. The teeth being the fortifications, the airfields, the coast artillery sites, the pillboxes, and so on, the places where the action happened. But of course, behind that, there's a whole infrastructure, and every member of the military has a family life, for example, or a social life of some kind, and then there's the communal life that they have when they're not actually at work. And that whole landscape that lies behind the bunkers, to put it really simply, I think is a really important part of the picture. It's the same for all of us. You know, you work in a university, but it's not only the university that's important, it's everything that sort of falls behind that as well. And the social life that we have as academics, for example, doesn't only happen within the university, it happens in other places too. And if you're interested in the sort of social side of things rather than just the places, then that wider landscape, if you like, is really important, I think. So I do see it as a part of the field of conflict archaeology. It's just what soldiers and sailors are doing when they're not actually on their ships or in their barracks.
Exactly. Before moving on to talk about, just in the last couple of minutes that we have, about a new project that you're working on, perhaps we could mention the book that you've written.
Yes, that's what a good idea. So this is published by Mid-Sea Books, and it's called Straight Street, Malta's Red Light District Revealed, Red Light District being in parentheses, because it wasn't really the red light district of Valletta, but it's very much it's intended to be two things. It's an orientation. So a large part of the book is designed as a walk down Straight Street and then back up the other side, and it takes you through building by building what the various bars were, the stories behind them, and so on. Of course, it's not definitive, it's not complete. There's lots of gaps in the story, but that's what we have at this stage. And we hope that by publishing the book, more information will come out.
That's what maybe, I was going to say. Perhaps a lot more information will come out of the woodwork.
Well, that would be wonderful, and maybe a second edition at some point can really fill some of those gaps. So it's an orientation, but it's also framing that study within the context of cultural heritage and the idea that this place is important. It's a place that will change in the future, just as it's changed in the past. It will have a future, and we're in a happy position now where we can perhaps start to influence what that future might be. And the key message of the book is that the people who live in Straight Street, it's their place after all. They should have a role in deciding what that future should be.
And the book is available in shops now? Or?
Yes, it is. Yes, it came out in February, so it's available and from the Mid-Sea Books website.
I know that you're working on a project working with the homeless. We don't, unfortunately, have much time left, but do tell us about it, because it sounds really fascinating.
Yes, it's comparable to the work that's been done in Straight Street. This is a project that is largely the brainchild and the work of one of my PhD students at the University of York, Rachel Kiddy. And it's a project that involves initially working with the homeless community in Bristol, and now with the homeless community in York. And it's very much about it's recognising that that heritage is something that everybody should be able to participate in. It's not only something for the elite, the middle class, the heritage professionals, the experts, so to speak. It's something that everyone should be able to engage with. Everyone has heritage. They might not necessarily call it heritage, but everyone has it, even homeless people. They have places that they value, landscapes that they like, journeys that they make through a city that maybe other people don't make. They have values, attached values to places, and this project is about giving them a voice, basically, allowing them to tell us what those values are.
Well, I hope that when that project is finished, you'll come back and tell us about it in more detail on University Matters. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Schofield, coming to talk to us today.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.